This is Community Voices on NPR Illinois. I'm co-host Randy Eccles. We're joined by a friend of the station, Jonathan Raymond. Jonathan, thanks for coming into the show today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jonathan and I were discussing in the past, he had helped out quite a bit with fundraising and pitching back in the day when we used to do a lot more of the traditional style fundraising. Mm-hmm. So thank you for all that.
You're welcome.
You also spent time at the Illinois State Museum.
Yes, I was a curator of anthropology there from 1994 until 2015 when former Governor Rauner shut it down and put a lot of us out of work.
That was a sad time with the two-year budget impasse. And think of all the places I know, Illinois State Museum got impacted the most.
The one thing that really disturbed me, he said it was to save money, but yet we made money through admissions and programs and grants. We were in the black. His argument really was just a fight with Madigan.
From what you know, has the museum recovered?
To an extent, they don't have a permanent director. It's interim or acting director. They have not replaced all the curators they lost.
There was a lot of talent there.
Yeah, oh, tremendous. I mean, they were internationally known curators like the late Eric Grimm. I'm not sure they replaced the money that we had brought in through grants from National Science Foundation or NEH and so forth. One of the biggest things we brought in over time was I was able to secure a bequest from a woman named Ida Klassen. She gave us 2/3 of her estate in perpetuity, and we got checks twice a year. By the time I had left, which wasn't all that long after her death, we had gotten something like $240,000, $250,000. Now it's probably double or triple that.
That's really significant for any nonprofit to be able to have that type of revenue to help them.
Yes, and forever.
There's a lot of challenge to museums, higher education, sciences, grants, all those things. Are you finding your work being impacted by some of these changes?
No, I'm retired and have been since Rauner put us out of business, so to speak, even though it reopened 9 or 10 months later. It hasn't affected me, but I am very dismayed when I read about NPR, for example, losing funding, Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Defunding is a challenge that we continue to address at the federal level. A lot of different organizations, sciences, arts, culture, and education, are facing some changes and trying to figure out what to do. You said you retired after the budget impasse and Illinois State Museum impact, but I know you've been keeping busy because you've come today to talk about a book you've authored.
People say, when you're retired, oh, now you have all this free time. I've never had free time. I took that time to start to write things I couldn't write when I was a curator because all the duties of the curatorship were such that I didn't have a lot of time. Since then, I've written and published 21 books. This book, and then I have another one coming out in a week or so on my professional work. What I've managed to do, which I'm proud of, is I have now, with the next book that comes out, I will have published all my professional research over a career that spanned 60 some odd years.
That's a really nice thing to be able to do with your career. Nice capstone. How do these books then get used? Are they researchers using them? Are they a textbook being used in class?
This book is used by researchers. It's won this prize from New Mexico as the best archaeology book of the year for 2025. So that's boosted sales. The next book that's coming out is really interesting in how it's been used. It's called Millions of Gifts for the Gods, the Feather Distribution Project, which was a 34-year project that I had providing feathers to Native peoples, mostly in the Southwest, but elsewhere. They could maintain their religious practices and their First Amendment right to freedom of religion, which the government was curtailing. We gave away 14.5 million plus feathers.
Where'd you get all those feathers?
From volunteers in Illinois and almost every other state in the Union. We also got them from abroad. There was a club, the Hong Kong Parrot Club, and they sent me feathers. There was a veterinary clinic in Toronto, Canada. They sent feathers, and we distributed these feathers. The book has been available for advance purchase. The places that are buying the advances are the Pueblos themselves, because as a couple of their reviewers said about the book, we never knew this about ourselves. Having an oral tradition, not a written tradition, much of this was lost, and they knew why they used feathers, but they didn't know when they first used feathers, which was 2,000 years ago.
It has to be really satisfying to see your work end up being a real help to the culture.
It was. It really was. They were all free of charge, but I did get some really nice perks from the Pueblos. For example, I was able to stay overnight where Anglos normally couldn't stay overnight. I could attend ceremonies that Anglos couldn't. I had meals with people. All sorts of nice things that happened, including one man in one of the Pueblos, I won't mention which one, wanted me to marry his daughter so he could get all the feathers. And I said to him, "You know, I am married." He said, "Originally, we had more than one wife." I said, "Well, I don't think that Laura's going to agree to that."
Yeah, hey, I came back from a visit and got some news.
Yeah. How do you think about Francine here?
Right. How interesting a path your career has led you to. Are you focused mostly on Southwest archaeology, anthropology?
I am. I firmly believe that our lives change markedly by events we can control. I wanted to be an Egyptologist from age 6 or 7 or 8. I had learned hieroglyphics in the 6th grade. I took Latin in high school. I learned ancient Greek. I learned Hebrew. And I was trying to learn Arabic because I knew I'd need all that. I went to Ecuador with a professor for a chance to work with the living people, the Chachi of northwestern Ecuador, to do a restudy. They were very isolated. And when we came back, the 67 Arab-Israeli War had come and gone, and there was no research opportunities anymore for me in the Middle East for quite a while. I had a chance to go to the Southwest, to Acoma Pueblo in New Mexico, with a professor. I went the morning I woke up and I was on Acoma land and stepped out of our vehicle and I looked around. I fell in love with the place. From then on, I was a Southwestern archaeologist. That's what started this, which ended up being a 55-year project. In 1968, I had moved to Santa Fe. I was working to get my doctorate in anthropology. The first book I read was a 1920 publication by a man named George Pepper for the American Museum of Natural History called Pueblo Bonito. In the beginning, the head of the anthropology program, Clark Whistler, at the American Museum of Natural History said, "I want to thank George Pepper, Dr. Pepper, for printing in full his field notes and diaries from Pueblo Bonito." And immediately I thought, no, that's not possible. No archaeologist publishes all they have. That got me on a 55-year quest to find all of Pepper's and Richard Wetherill's and others' unpublished materials. Wrote it up. University of New Mexico Press seemed the obvious place because it was Chaco Canyon, New Mexico. They published it.
Congratulations on the award. It's
thank you.
Good to be recognized. We're talking with Jonathan Raymond. He has a variety of books he's published, but he has one out right now, Pueblo Bonito and Chaco Canyon. Pueblo Bonito means beautiful home or
beautiful
something?
Town.
Tell me a little bit about this town, this area of New Mexico that you've researched for.
Chaco Canyon is a canyon. The central part of it is about 7 miles long. In that 7 miles, they have 12 what are called great houses, really large pueblos, of which Pueblo Bonito is the largest. And then there are a number of outlying great houses as well on Chaco Canyon National Historic Park land, but they're not connected. You have to go a couple of miles, and then there's another part of the park. This place was a mecca for ancient Pueblo or ancestral Pueblo, as they're now called, development. The canyon, when it started, had an arroyo, which was actually a flowing river. Through time, the climate changed, things happened. By 1150 to 1200, it was pretty much empty. There was a short repopulation around 1325 to 1375, but then it was abandoned completely. And later, when the Navajo came down from northern North America, they moved in. It is spectacular. If anyone has a reason or an inclination to look at archaeological sites aside from, say, Cahokia, which in itself is incredible, Chaco Canyon, Mesa Verde are the places to go. They are paradise.
It's amazing to think back that long. It sounds like through all your research and studies, you have a real sense of what this looked like, what it might have been to have been back in that time. And anthropology and archaeology, that's what it's about.
Yeah.
Help us understand how things were.
And how to apply that information to now. Because when things at Chaco got so bad environmentally that they could no longer stay there, they picked up and moved. But if things get that bad environmentally for us, we have no place to go. Space travel and planetary existence, whether it's Mars or the moon, is impossible now and won't be for generations. We've got to look at what we have and think, how can we keep this and make it better?
The environment that we like so much here is water dependent, and a lot of the other options, like you said, we don't have space travel really yet, but
no.
The options are like deserts that we have here.
Yeah, and we do have actually a primitive desert in Mason City State Park. There is a geological desert. They've got desert plants, they've got sand, they've got cacti. It's incredible, and it's here in Illinois. It's a result of glaciation that came down and put all this sand and so forth in one particular place.
I didn't realize we had one right here in the backyard.
Mason City State Park.
Jonathan, you've written this book. If people are interested in reading it or learning more about your work, where can they find it?
You can order it directly from the University of New Mexico Press, and it comes in four types. It comes as a hardback, paperback, ebook, and then they have a program where you can rent it, and I don't know what format, but I'm guessing the ebook. Then when your lease, so to speak, has run out, you send it back.
And the book, again, is called Pueblo Bonito and Chaco Canyon.
Revisited, technically, the published versus the unpublished record.
We were talking about your time with the Illinois State Museum, and I don't think a lot of people understand the scope of the museum and how much excellent work they've done over the years. I was surprised just to see the research warehouse. Was that where you were based, or were you based at the
Research
museum?
And Collection Center on Ash Street.
It's large, and there are a lot of artifacts there.
I was in charge of curating the materials, for example, from the Southwest. The amount of materials was over 100,000 objects. They've got literally millions of objects, and they have some of the great collections in the United States, and people don't realize that. For example, they have in the history department, they have one of the great collections of flies and lures and other fishing equipment. They have the guns from the miners' strike and rebellion in the, was it 1930s? They have all the guns that were confiscated by the National Guard. They have wonderful Navajo textiles, including Navajo textiles that only a couple, but they go back to the start of Navajo weaving in the United States. That is back to the 17th century. Those are among the earliest anywhere in the United States. They have a tremendous African collection, and we did a number of exhibitions about Africa. One of them was out of the Department of Transportation. It was called Where the Animals Dance. We had masks and outfits and all sorts of materials. And then, because it was important, we repatriated burial memorials to Kenya before I left the museum.
And that's become more of a trend in the museum era, is returning things to where they came from, right?
Yeah, repatriating. And we had no problem with that. The problem was we had so many and we had to build wooden crates. But the Kenyan government took charge of them and flew them back to Kenya, where they were put back in the villages where they were taken. And they now have fencing, at least last I knew, they have fencing around to protect them from theft.
Is most of the collection Illinois-based? You mentioned Navajo things and things from the Southwest.
It is, mostly Illinois and surrounding states as well. The Southwest we got from a local resident named Thomas Condell. Edwards Place is part of the Condell family. He was a collector, and he had a shop downtown in the basement of the Reen Bank. At one point, his father told him, you've got to start selling some of that collection. He did. He'd sell one piece and buy 50 others. And so one of the things we got from the Condells was an amazing collection of Valentine's Day cards that one of his sisters ancestors had collected, Japanese armor and swords. And Thomas Condell is one of these people who whatever he touches turns to gold. He goes to Missouri and he opens a fluorite mine, which was the largest fluorite producing mine in the United States. Goes to Colorado to a place called Silver Cliff. He has the largest silver mine in the United States.
I appreciate you joining us today, Jonathan. One last question about the museum and the collections. The way that's basically handled is, like you said, special exhibitions bring things out of the research center and into the museum for display, and then that gets rotated back into proper storage.
Right. We used to have a couple of days a year where we had research and collections day, and the center was open and people could come, no appointment, come and look at various collections, whether it's fossils or pollen samples from the various collections, and they loved it.
I did. I got to go out once, and it's crazy because it's the museum on steroids. It's so much more to look at.
Museums put out infinitely small part of their collection, and the museum was where I met my wife. I had met her. I asked her if she'd like to bring her class to the museum. She thought, this is wonderful, and she did. She was teaching at Isles at the time, and she brought her class, and while they were looking around and looking at various things, I asked her if she wanted to go out. She said yes. 3 years later, we got married.
So you were looking around too.
By the way, the museum has the largest collection of glass trade beads that were used to trade with native peoples in the world, the Frost Trade Bead Collection. It's important to support museums. They are a window to the past, but they also show you the future. They need your support, just like so many of the other arts do.
Jonathan Raymond, we really appreciate you coming in to Community Voices today. His latest book, Pueblo Benito and the Chaco Canyon Revisited, the published and unpublished record, is available through the University of New Mexico Press. We'll put a link to it at nprillinois.org.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I wish you well given the constraints that you're operating on.
We appreciate that, and with everybody's help, we'll find a way to navigate on.